3:30 and August 13th from 10 to 11:30. Advance registration is required by going to gtc.edu/AAM. According to the release, graduates of the program can expect to earn around $49,000 a year. It's 8:10 in sports. Checking the baseball schedule, the Cardinals play the Brewers in Milwaukee this afternoon at 1. This evening, the White Sox are in Kansas City, and the Pirates play the Cubs, all with no fans present. Yesterday, the final game of a four-game series between the Cubs and Reds was postponed because of rain. The forecast, mostly sunny skies today, a high around 80, a little cooler near Lake Michigan. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 62. Continued dry and warm tomorrow, a high around 80. Then for Sunday, a 40% chance of showers and storms during the afternoon and evening. No change in temperature. Right now, 73. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, two interesting conversations from the morning show archives. In part one, the author of a book called The Design of Future Things. In part two, an intriguing look at the millennial generation and how they tend to function in the workplace and how employers can do a better job of keeping millennials happy and successful in the workplace. Before we get to our interviews today, a quick word about what's coming up this weekend on The Morning Show. Tomorrow on The Morning Show's podcast version, you're going to be hearing a conversation from all the way back in 1998 with a baseball fan extraordinaire from Racine named John Salvo, who's methodically made his way through each and every major league ballpark across the country. And we'll be hearing from that conversation about that. On Sunday, we'll be replaying a conversation that involved the phenomenon of Rosie the Riveter and includes a conversation with a woman from Racine who was such a Rosie the Riveter, that is, a woman who found herself taking a place on the main line of manufacturing during World War II. A really intriguing conversation that will be on Sunday's Morning Show podcast. To subscribe to the podcast version of The Morning Show, you can go to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Make sure you search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Here's today's program. I'm Gregory Berg. The following Morning Show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. Enjoy. I'm excited for the next few minutes here on WGTD as I speak today with Donald A. Norman, the Breed Professor of Design at Northwestern University, a former vice president of Apple Computer, a partner in the Nielsen Norman Group consulting firm, which consults with a variety of corporations on the question of design. And he's written a number of different books about design, including one which has just been released called The Design of Future Things, in which Professor Norman explores some really intriguing questions about how and why we design some of the innovative things which we do, and some of the questions which we need to ask and maybe don't always ask about exactly what we want, exactly what we need, the way things work, and the way in which we sometimes misunderstand the nature of some of the things which we create.
No. It's the things that misunderstand us. Let's get our priorities straight.
Yes, very good. Again, the book is called The Design of Future Things, and it is published by Basic Books. And Professor Norman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Ahead of talking specifically about your book, I wonder if you could give me just a little idea of how you found yourself in the field of design itself. I mean, does this go back a long time, maybe even into your childhood?
It may. It may. I just, in fact, wrote an essay for someone who asked me that question, and I said, it was a radio back in the old days when I was a child, and I peered into the mysterious innards of a radio and wondered, gee, what's going on? What's moving? How does it work? Because all these mechanical things, you could push a lever and see it work something. So you could figure it out. But with a radio, there was nothing in there, just glowing tubes. This was really a long time ago, so they had something called vacuum tubes that nobody today remembers.
Hmm. That comment reminds me of something that actually came up on this program not long ago when I spoke to an engineer, actually, about a book which he has written, kind of celebrating what engineers do and designers. And he has a whole section of his book in which he talks about and has photographs which depict the notion of the facade and the fact that so much of what we build now is built in such a way that the workings of things are hidden. I mean, very much on purpose, so we don't see what's actually going on. And, of course,
when it comes to electronics, there's no choice. The workings of a computer are done by mysterious green electrons. They really are green, you know. Mysterious green electrons that whiz about. And so inside the circuitry, there is nothing to be seen. And if you open up one of these boxes, you see, well, little black rectangles. So we're at the mercy of some designer. Somebody is sitting someplace at 2 a.m. saying, oh, I got a neat idea, and who decides that the way you should change your alarm clock time is by holding down this button, pushing those two, and hoping you get the right time.
Hmm.
And for him, it's perfectly logical. Gee, why would anybody have trouble with this? If you have trouble with this, you shouldn't be using it.
Hmm.
So that's my old book. My new book is I've seen the future, and I don't like it. We're now putting intelligence in these devices. So I'm driving my car, and I try to switch lanes, and the car says, no, I won't let you switch lanes. Ask for permission first. The turn signal, which you used to use to tell other cars you want to switch lane, that's now how you tell your own car you want to switch a lane. Your refrigerator will say, you can't have that cake. It's not on your diet. Your house will say, you're in a bad mood today. I'm playing your favorite music. What do you mean you don't want that music? Why is it your favorite then? That's what I'm worried about.
Let me ask you about something that you say in the first chapter of your book, which is called Cautious Cars and Cantankerous Kitchens. And I think you've just touched on a couple of tangible examples of exactly that. You say machines have less power than humans, so they have more authority. And you kind of anticipate our reaction by saying contradictory, yes, but oh so true. Help us understand what you're saying there. Machines have less power than humans, so they have more authority.
When you call up your phone company to complain about the bill or to change something, or when you go to any store and talk to the clerk and you complain, what does the clerk say? The clerk says, I don't know, I just work here. Doesn't know what to do. The clerk doesn't set the rules. Therefore, the clerk has more authority over you. You're hopeless. Helpless, I guess the word is. Both hopeless and helpless. You cannot argue with the clerk because the clerk has no authority. That's the way it is with our intelligent devices. If your car suddenly decides to brake because it thinks that you're driving dangerously, you can't convince it that it's perfectly safe because you can't talk to it. That's why people with less power have more power.
Hmm. You just talked about not being able to really communicate with one's car, for instance. I think one of the points of your book is that we sometimes misunderstand something that sort of seems like communication on the surface as not being communication at all. You say that the communication capability of given machines is not communication at all because it's two monologues rather than a dialogue. Explain that a little further.
Right. Engineers love to talk about human-machine communication, and we talk about human-machine interaction. But it's not real interaction. It's because we command our machines. We do that by setting a switch or pushing a button or choosing a menu item, and it does something, and then it commands us by giving us something back, and we have to choose, or it says, I'm about to crash. Okay? Oh, sure. We have no choice. So that's not real communication. We send messages to it. It sends messages to us. There are two monologues. And as you say, two monologues are not a dialogue.
Hmm. So you posed the question shortly thereafter, then, how can we change the way we interact with our machines to take better advantage of their strengths and virtues and at the same time eliminate their annoyances? To what extent is that possible?
Well, my favorite machine is a calculator. The calculator doesn't work at all like the human brain. It doesn't pretend to. And actually, that's its virtue. We make mistakes when we do arithmetic and computations, and the calculator doesn't. So it works completely differently than us, and it's a very good assistant because many of us find it absolutely essential. And actually, modern science couldn't be done without the powerful calculators that scientists use. But it's a tool. It doesn't go off and decide, oh, this is a better problem to solve, or it doesn't say, why are you solving this problem, or that's not a good method, here's a better method. It lets us be in control, and it provides us with advice, and it takes over the stuff that we find hard, and lets us do the stuff that we do well. That's a good example.
Hmm. It's interesting you say that about, I mean, the calculator does something for us that we perhaps don't necessarily want to do or need to do ourselves. That is, of course, what a lot of inventors and designers do when they attempt to automate certain things. You point out, however, that pretty much without exception, when we give a machine, when we automate it, we are only partially automating it. And we sometimes forget that it is an incomplete automation. And so we are still sort of left hanging, needing to sort of hover and be ready to intervene when something goes wrong or when it's necessary for us to sort of take over. You paint a picture there in which we're not really being helped maybe as much as we might think by that partial automation.
Right, but you see, you yourself slipped into this nasty language of kind of blaming the person for the problem. You say, we sometimes forget that it's not fully automated. Wait a minute. Why should it be our responsibility? It should be the machine's responsibility. So it should be the designer's responsibility not to let us get into that situation. You know, lots of accidents are blamed on human error. In fact, most accidents, something like 75 to 85% are blamed on human error. Now, wait a minute. You know, if so much is blamed on human error, maybe it isn't humans at all. Maybe we're asking people to do things that they can't do very well, like pay continuous, complete attention for an 8-hour work shift. Nobody can do that. Most people can't. I bet you everybody has drifted off during this very conversation and hasn't attended to every single word. Drifting off for 10 seconds, 30 seconds, gee, an hour is not uncommon. So why don't we design things that take this into account? People make mistakes when there's a big, long row of switches. We sometimes flip the wrong switch. Many of us have turned on or off the wrong burner on our stoves. So, gee, we know that this happens. Why don't we design equipment to take this into account? So let's not fall into this deadly trap of saying, oh, sometimes people forget. Nah.
Granted. Okay, I understand your point. But a little later in your book, you say, in posing this really intriguing question of how we can cooperate most usefully with our machines, you say we need to regard the interaction somewhat as we do interaction with animals. I mean, the way you phrase that is, I mean, at least some of the responsibility is ours to understand these tools that we're purchasing with our own money and that we are choosing to use.
Yes, Yes, that's true, but I think the main responsibility lies in the heads of the designers and the engineers to really understand people better. They pride themselves in understanding the machines and the technology, but we've got to understand the people, so, again, we don't put people into these circumstances. And mind you, we can have great success. The best example is air traffic, commercial aviation. Lots of people have studied automation and the use of aviation for years and years, and so many of my examples were drawn from aviation, but people in aviation learn their lessons. So now flying an airplane is one of the most safe activities you can do. We sometimes go for years without any deaths in commercial aviation. That's not true in any other of these sports. So, sports, activities.
Can you help us understand why that success has been achieved in that particular arena and not in these others that we're talking about? What's different about that particular technology and the way it's been developed?
Well, there are several differences. One of them is the extreme care and attention that has been given to the design with teams of designers that include social scientists who study and understand people. However, in many ways, the aviation situation is easier than, say, the automobile situation. Because in an airplane, you have two very highly trained pilots who have been practiced on all sorts of problems in simulators, which are really realistic. If I put you in a simulator, you would not distinguish it from a real airplane. It's that good. And they practiced every possible emergency situation that one can imagine. So that's one big thing. Well-trained, well-practiced. And second time, you're in your airplane, everything goes wrong, the airplane starts diving to Earth, you still have 2 or 3 minutes. And there have been several cases where when this happens, the pilots save the airplane. In the automobile, you have an ill-trained driver who probably isn't paying attention. And when something goes wrong, you may have a half second to respond. So the situation is much more complex.
Hmm. We're speaking with Donald A. Norman. We're talking about his brand-new book called The Design of Future Things. Perhaps you know him from a previous book called The Design of Everyday Things. You say, we are in the midst of a major change in how we relate to technology. Until recently, people have been in control. We turned the technology on and off, told it which operation to perform, and guided it through its operation. But you paint a picture now of technology becoming more powerful and complex, in which we understand it less and can predict its actions much less. It's really interesting to think about that, and the way you describe that, It's truly unsettling.
Yeah, that was the point.
So what are the ways, the tangible ways in which we can address that? I mean, what are tangible ways that a designer or an inventor might respond to what you just said?
First, empathy. In many ways, the secret to good design is empathy. Empathy with the people who are going to be using what you are designing. Now, empathy is actually not that easy to get, and quite often the designer is not a good person to actually understand how their device will be appreciated by other people. Just like a writer is a bad person to proofread their own writing. They're too close to the material, they understand it too well, they don't see the difficulties. So what I always train my students and I train my consulting clients is how to do field studies, how to hire social scientists to go out and watch people do their work, to try to understand the real difficulties people have. When you're trying to design a new product, you whip up what we call a prototype. It could be made out of paper and scotch tape, and it could be foam, or it could be a quick computer mock-up. Many times it's just sketches on paper. And we go out and we really try it. We ask people to make believe this is really working. We begin to see what can really happen in the world, how it will be used, and where the problems might come. This is very powerful, and that's how modern airplanes are designed. That's how modern computer systems are designed. And whatever your problems with modern computers, they are much, much better than they were 10 years ago.
You call yourself at one point a technologist. I actually had not seen that term until I read your book. And you say, I believe in making lives richer and more rewarding through the use of science and technology. Can you help us understand what you mean by that? I mean, the way in which one's life might be, for instance, made richer or more rewarding through the right kinds of innovations.
Well, the amusing thing is that all of us actually have lots of good, positive examples. We just don't call it technology. I think people think that the word technology means all that new stuff that I can't figure out and that drives me crazy. No, technology is basically anything that's invented by, manufactured by humans. So books are technology, pens and pencil are technology, your clothes are technology, the house you live in is technology. But these all work so very well, we take them for granted. But those are exactly good examples of what I'm talking about. What I want is this new modern stuff that confuses us so much to make it so good that we take it for granted, and therefore we no longer call it technology. You know, we don't even call a watch technology, and it's incredibly complex, high technology. But it's taken so much for granted, we don't buy it in the technology store, we buy it in the jewelry store. So that's what I'm talking about.
When you are talking about the way in which certain technology tries to convey signals to us, you paint a kind of almost comical picture of how there's just, in a sense, too much beeping going on in our lives. I mean, we hear something, we got to figure out, is that the dishwasher, is that the microwave, what in the world is beeping at me, and why? And you pose kind of an interesting alternative to the impersonal sound of the beep or the buzzer.
Yeah, so actually, let me see if this works. What did you just hear?
Yeah, we heard a door close.
Yeah, you could tell just by the very sound that it was a door closing. And when my teapot whistles, I know it's my teapot because the whistle is very distinctive. And on top of that, I can hear it sort of making gurgling sounds beforehand. So if I'm nearby, I can see, oh, it's about to boil.
Well, and it's a real authentic sound. I mean, being created for, I mean, it's being very directly created by what's going on physically within it.
Precisely. And so what happens today is that, again, the designers who are really clueless about how people work, designers, and let me actually blame engineers more than my friends, the designers, say, oh, let me see. Ooh, the cost of this is getting too high. Oh, I can find a little beeper for a tenth of a cent, so we'll put in a beeper. I've been in hospitals recently as a scientist observer. I'm doing a study with the National Research Council. We're walking around in hospitals, following physicians, and there are beeps all over. And I remember one day I was standing in the hall with a bunch of physicians, and there was this beep, 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 beep coming out of the ceiling. So I said, what is that signaling? And they said, oh, none of us can ever figure it out. We just ignore it. So why is it doing that? So all the medical equipment, each one goes beep. Each one sounds the same. Worse than that, two different brands of equipment doing the very same thing will signal its problems slightly differently. In the home, my microwave, my refrigerator door even beeps if I leave it open too long. My alarm clocks, I could go on forever. I have a little hot water thing that even when it's finished, it plays a little tune. It's amazing. So we're being driven crazy. I remember one night being awakened by some beep. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was driving me crazy. And it took me 5 minutes of wandering about the house trying to locate it and figure out what it was.
Well, and it's interesting that all these things get developed, and it's as though they have only one little bank of possible sounds from which to draw. And so we have these beeps that are all but indistinguishable from one another. I mean,
exactly the problem. They have one little bank of possible things to draw from, and that bank is whatever you can make most cheaply, which is a beep.
You talk also about how we can think about this not only in auditory terms, but for instance, even the way a mechanical knob is designed and constructed, that the way it turns, if there's clicking or resistance or whatever, that gives us certain cues from which we can draw helpful information. But again, designers might or might not be thinking about something like that.
Remember the early days of digital radios in your car, when if you wanted to make it louder, you had to find the up button and hold it down for a little while. And it was really hard either to tune your station, make it louder or softer. And thank goodness most car radios have gone back to knobs because, gee, you can use a knob without looking. You just reach your hand out, you feel it, and you have really good tactile sense. You know just how far you've turned it, you remember the position, and if the knob is done right, it feels good. In fact, good designers actually squirt in some viscous oil, into the control so it feels silky. Feels good.
There's a fascinating moment in your book, in fact, in this same chapter, which we've just now been discussing, in which you start talking about a very intriguing concept called reverse risk compensation, in which the way something might be designed in terms of how risky or dangerous it appears to be can really have tremendous effect on the behavior of one who might or might not use something.
Yep.
Explain to our listeners what you're talking about there.
Things that look dangerous can actually be safer. So suppose you're in your car and there's a straight, empty highway in front of you, with no other vehicles. Well, gee, you don't pay much attention. You can even go fast. In fact, but when if another car comes, you might be completely unaware or unexpecting it. Many, many fatal car injuries happen on deserted farm country roads because these people are used to driving it at high speeds where nobody else is around. And then when someone else comes, crumph, they crash into each other. There could be no other car around for 25 miles, and these two have collided. Happens. Now, if you make the road look really dangerous, narrow and winding and a little narrow bridge and maybe not so well lit, you drive more cautiously. As a result, it's safer. And so there's an engineer in Europe who's been actually experimenting with this. He goes into a city and he convinces them to get rid of the stoplights, get rid of the pedestrian walks, get rid of the stop signs, make the streets more narrow, not wider. And guess what? Not only do the accident rates go down, but actually you can get through the city faster. That's because even though you're driving more slowly and a little bit more cautiously, you don't have to stop at stoplights and stop signs. So you're going through faster with less accidents. It's called, there's a technical term, it's called risk homeostasis. But basically it means if it looks dangerous, you'll be more careful.
In your book, you pose a very interesting scenario of us approaching the whole realm of design not as we do right now, primarily as an art form or a craft. You want us to think about it differently, and you say it's time for a science of design. Explain what you mean by that and what sort of difference that would potentially make in terms of what we've been talking about today.
Historically, design has come from the arts. Many designers were trained either in art or in architecture. They are very concerned about the visual statement that the designs make, about the aesthetic sense. Now, I happen to believe those are very, very important. They make a big difference in our enjoyment of life. But as we get to more complex devices, and especially as we move to the future with devices that have some built-in intelligence, we need more than that. We need actually to do it in a controlled, sensible, systematic way, and that's what I'm calling the science of design, or more accurately would be the engineering of design. And this means to use what are by now are fairly well-established procedures for observation, watching in the field. We call it rapid ethnography. For determining what the designs ought to be, we call that rapid prototyping, with what we call an iterative design method, so that you try out your idea quickly. Maybe it takes you an hour or two to make a prototype, go out and try it with people, come back and refine it. All the way through designing for sustainability, designing for manufacturing, designing for unmanufacturing, so that if you're using sustainable materials, you can actually recover them at the end. And of course, you have to make sure that the company can actually earn some money from the designs, because if a company loses money, it doesn't matter how good the design. So all these factors had to be brought into together, and there are ways. The better design companies today follow these practices. and the better schools are teaching these practices. But still the vast majority of people are in many ways untrained. They are came from art school. They don't understand business. They don't understand technology. But they do understand aesthetics. We need them, but they have to be part of this larger, more systematic approach. Mm.
The book, again, is called The Design of Future Things. It's published by Basic Books, the author, Donald A. Norman. Professor Norman, I've really found this to be a very, very interesting and intriguing conversation. I'm glad that you could join us today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book. Best
Thank
wishes
you
to you.
Much. Thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. I speak for the next few minutes with Dr. Joanne Sajansky, who is the co-author of a very interesting book called Keeping the Millennials, Why Companies Are Losing Billions in Turnover to This Generation and What to Do About It. The book addresses a certain slice of our working population, a generation which some call the millennials. They are born between 1980 and 1999, and they are a sizable slice of the working population. And because as a group they enter the workforce with certain ideas and particularly certain expectations, it's really interesting to chart how they are doing in the world of corporate America especially. And this book is written to help companies better understand how the millennials think and operate and work, and the best way to work effectively with this particular population. The book is published by Wiley. The author I'm speaking with today, Dr. Joanne Sajansky, is a certified speaking professional, founder and CEO of Key Group, an international speaking training, executive coaching, and assessment firm, and former national president of the American Society for Training and Development. And Dr. Joanne Sajansky, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg, and please feel free to call me Joanne.
I am very intrigued by this notion of the millennials, this particular generation. And at some point in the book, you point out that what makes the current situation quite complicated is that for the first time in history, the workplace now comprises four distinct generations: the matures, the baby boomers, Generation X, and then the millennials. So tell us the way in which this situation is particularly complicated.
Well, it's complicated for a lot of reasons. If we first take a look at who raised the millennials, we'll probably say for the most part it was the baby boomer group. So our thoughts about what work could be and what we hoped for were the things that guided us as we raised our children. And that was, you know, go for it. You can do whatever it is that you plan to do. You're bright. You're smart. We're getting you the education. You'll have all the tools that you need. And so, therefore, this real high self-confidence, this ability to believe if I am clever enough, smart enough, good enough, you know, I can move ahead, make more money, be promoted. So, and a lot of things that the boomers started that didn't really catch on as well as it might have are things that the millennials are asking for now. For instance, the millennials are really pushing for a little bit of flex time and, you know, to have some adjustment in schedule to be able to sort of have a life, you know. And if you remember, the boomers really pushed for that. They wanted parental leave and those kinds of things. So the boomers started it. The traditionalists, or the mature generation, whichever you might prefer to call them, from 1995, are and older, excuse me, the traditionalists, I mean, you have a 75, 78-year-old person working in a workplace, and maybe right around the corner, a boomer sitting by a Gen X, and in comes the new hire, the new millennial, is here. And the conflict comes from, a little bit, I am what I've been through, So I've had certain things happen in my life as a person in my 50s that are probably quite a bit different than may have happened in a person who's 26 and in the workplace. So there's this experience difference. There might be a values difference. The way we talk is different. Some of our corporate folks tell us they can't understand half the things millennials say because there's so much jargon, and a language that's just theirs. And they complain about them doing four things at a time. They're texting, they're talking to me, they're in the meeting, And so it's a multitasking kind of situation that sometimes older employees don't appreciate. And what happens with Gen X, that group, 1965 to 1979, with that group, you hear that, they also had boomer parents, some of them, and they were the first sort of latchkey kids, we called them. The Gen X's came home from school and didn't have so many of the programs and stuff. And maybe think, too, that when they came out in the market, it wasn't that good of a job market either. And they ended up taking waitress jobs and things like that until they found, quote, their real job in their real career. So sometimes I think there might be a little bit of a little jealousy or a little feeling of, oh, no, here they come. So it can be complex and complicated so that it doesn't work, or it could be complex and complicated and wonderful because different ideas come to the table. People share things. They have different skills, different backgrounds, and it can be marvelous, but it takes some adjusting on everybody's part. And the position I take doing the kind of work I do as a management consultant is to say, okay, what can this corporation do that millennials are asking for that can help everybody, And what adjustment do some millennials need? I've had millennials tell me after they've been on a job for a year and they look back and see some of the things they did, they're embarrassed because they just didn't know certain things were inappropriate in business. Like they talk to, instead of talking to their boss, they go see the boss's boss and think nothing of it, or speak out of the meeting in a way that was probably not appropriate because some visitors were there.
Especially when they're, I remember you mentioning millennials tend to speak right up even when they're brand new on the job. I mean, they will speak up quite forthrightly about things that they don't like or certain concerns that they have or suggestions about changes, whereas other generations tend to be have a little more deference or shyer at first about sharing their opinions. Millennials don't seem to have that quality.
Yeah, and it's absolutely true. And the other, they are an impatient group, but one of the things I want to remind myself all the time is everything about me is not because I'm a boomer. Other things contribute to who I am. Things like how I was raised, how I was educated, what kind of work I do, based on, did I want to do this kind of work? I mean, this is my passion, what I do. So that makes who I am as a consultant or in prior years as an internal employee. So, it's not just by generation that we get our traits and values and so on. They come to us in other ways also. But many of the things that the millennials ask for, like flex time, like quick promotions, like having some fun places to go on their breaks and lunchtime, being engaged and asked about things that will affect them on the job, those kinds of things looked at and taken care of in a corporation can make it more attractive for a traditionalist to stay longer or a Gen X not to depart. Because people leaving before they really want to or before you want them to leave costs you lots of money. And we make that point pretty strongly in the book. If you make $50,000, it's a millennial and maybe a part of the country that, pays that kind of level, it either costs $25,000 to replace that person or maybe as high as 50. And some companies report to us that it takes twice that salary to find the person to fill it. That's a lot of money. In no time, people leave and you're out, millions of dollars. It can be very frightening. And then if you have an employee on the job who is not happy, who is not challenged, who isn't coached and help to improve more, you've got lost productivity right there because he or she is not doing for the company what they could be doing or for themselves.
I'm glad you mentioned that last point because, you know, actually, of course, in some respects, the moment we find ourselves in right now as a nation is one in which there are probably not quite so many people blithely walking out of a decently paying job for any reason. I mean, I think more people than was the case, let's say, 2 years ago, are probably hanging tight and looking at their jobs a little bit differently than was once the case. But even in a moment like that, where to some extent that's probably occurring, this issue of who the millennials are is just as important, because it's important for employees and coworkers and so on to understand where they're coming from, and maybe for the millennials themselves to kind of understand where they're coming from. As you say, so something as important as productivity isn't compromised.
Right, absolutely. And money is lost in ways that just doesn't need to be lost. People, even when times are good and they're hiring, very often our hiring techniques do not provide us good job matches with the job that exists and the person who's sitting there as an applicant. So we recommend that people take this hiring process very seriously. I mean, most companies do, but they might not have the resources or have found the resources to do it, you know, that interview well. One of the worst things that happens is in a job interview is people sell the millennial the job by telling the millennial it's a laid-back work, there's lots of flexibility, you know, as a supervisor, this person will do this, this, and this for you, and they get there and it's not true. Then they want to walk right then, you know, because they wanted to have the truth spoken in terms of the corporate culture and their boss and the kind of freedoms they'll have and so on. Also, we need to make sure that it's a talent match, you know, that this person coming in really does match up with this job pretty well. And so we use tools like, we use Profiles International. That's a group that provides tools to help that hiring manager. So I think first we need to think about doing that job match, and then once they're there, for a year, doing what we used to try to throw into a one-day orientation. Remember those? You come on the job, you hear about your benefits and so on. Now, for millennials, it would take a whole year to onboard, and different activities happen throughout that time period so they can become more familiar with the company, you know, get to know what a division or the parent company does, things like that, so they might feel a little bit more hooked in and therefore feel a little bit more loyal. Because part of the problem with the millennial group is they saw their parents lose jobs. You know, they saw their parents work hard and be somewhere for 25 years and then let go. And they don't want the same things to happen to them.
So they are, that's one of the reasons why when they walk in a door, they are not thinking to themselves, I might very likely be working here for the next 35 years.
Well, I can't tell you, not even one millennial that I've heard that from. And I've interviewed thousands. I can't. Either by survey, you know, or a phone or in-person discussion. I don't think I've ever heard that.
Hmm. And it's interesting. It's almost as though they have no expectation that that would even be possible, nor is it something that they would probably even desire.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a kind of a combination.
I think they think it's boring. It's a little boring.
Right. You make many interesting observations about this millennial generation. One of the most intriguing, I mean, because it's one that had not occurred to me, is you said that many millennials have a much tighter connection to their parents than maybe the generation before. I mean, they are used to being in closer, more frequent touch with their own parents and rely on them more and more. You quote a professor from the University of Georgia saying that the ever-present cell phone is the world's longest umbilical cord, at least the way some people use it, and that it's important to understand this little facet of the typical millennial, that they're used to being parented to a larger extent, and those expectations might have some bearing on the workplace.
Oh, absolutely. We call them helicoptering parents because they hover, and some of the helicoptering parents really kick it in real high gear when they young people were at college, you know, and we had an example in the book, a true story, of a mother who came and cleaned the dorm room for her daughter every Saturday, a 2.5-hour drive to do that. You know, or people sitting in the lobby and they want to intervene in the interview process. They'll say, you know, if there's something you don't understand, you know, say something to the interviewer, come out, talk to me, and you can go back in. I mean, they're just unbelievable things to me as a boomer parent. I could never do, but we see it a lot, and we see corporations actually in some rare cases. We don't see it a lot yet, but and I'll be curious to see if it'll take off, but some are inviting parents into the onboarding activities and entertaining an evening where parents of all new hires are welcome. So young new hires, millennials who wish to bring their parents. So it's kind of a different approach, and we're speaking loudly, the boomers, and we held on to them very tightly. We took them to soccer, we took them here, we took them there, and somebody else drove them when we couldn't do it, and it was carpool, and we kept them busy every minute. We structured them, and once let go, I'm not sure why more of them just don't fall over.
Interesting. I wonder if we could just talk a moment about the way in which we are, in a sense, generalizing here, and that, of course, there have to be people of this generation who don't line up with any of these characteristics very much at all. How much care do we need to take in making these generalizations about, you know, literally millions and millions of people?
Actually, I want to take a lot of care, and I made the point earlier that we certainly become what we are for other things than our age. So, you know, we can't assume that age is the only thing that determines how we are, and we can't see that all millennials behave that way. I know for a fact that I have had millennial interns and millennial employees here who have very little of this behavior. I almost always see some level of disappointment if they're corrected. And I guess we just gave so much praise as boomer parents that this is a group that feels more disappointed by getting negative feedback than I've seen in the past. And I do see that one quite a bit. And I think that there is a multitasking that occurs. It's almost funny. I mean, they're wired when they're going here and there, and your cell phone does put them in touch with everyone. We're very cautious here. Everybody watches the cell phone situation, and we're not on it, so we're setting an example for the millennial employee, you know, not to be on it excessively. But I think that it's sort of sad that what can happen to a person who is stereotyped by his or her generation, and we should never do it. And what we should allow is time to get to know this employee as an employee and as a person, because they'll often say that children of business owners have a really high work ethic because they've seen their parents work real hard. I believe it's children of any hard-working, you know, ethical parent will more likely produce that kind of child, unless the young person feels that the parent's been used, abused, and then spit out, you know, of the corporation. Then they have very strong feelings about this never happening to them.
Right. And that you say that many millennials, for instance, really care about this notion of the work-life balance, they want to have a life in addition to their work.
Well, the boomers said that. I remember us saying it, and we wanted parental leave, you know, for dad when babies were born, too, and we pushed for a lot of things. But, yeah, they are very concerned about work-life balance, and I think it's because of what they see around them. You know, people who are stressed by work and then they're sick. You know, people who, and the millennials are sad, as I said, about things that their parents missed, and they don't want to be. They're really cautious and worried about being that same kind of parent.
The book is very intriguing, again, called Keeping the Millennials, Why Companies Are Losing Billions in Turnover to This Generation and What to Do About It. The book is published by Wiley. One of the two authors, Dr. Joanne Sojansky. I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. This has been interesting.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks so much.
And again, that conversation was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. This weekend on the Morning Show podcast, tomorrow, a baseball fan from Racine named John Salvo, a conversation from back in 1998, John Salvo talking about his lifelong pursuit of attending games in every Major League Baseball park, seeing every conceivable combination of teams playing in every single ballpark. On Sunday, you'll meet a woman from Racine, Joyce Hill Westerman, who was